You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Our journey to explore the 500-year globalization of our dinner plates continues this week with a look at chilies. And joining us now are two experts, Dave DeWitt, food historian and author of numerous books, including the Chili Pepper Encyclopedia, and Chef Roberto Santibanez of the Fonda Restaurants and author of his most recent book, Tacos, Tortas, and Tamales. I'm very pleased to welcome both of them to the fourth installment of our series, Globivores, Food Travels Around the World Since 1492. Hello.
Hello.
Hi there.
Dave, where in the Americas did chilies originate?
Well, chilies actually originated in what is now Bolivia and gradually moved around the Americas, spread by birds mostly. And then in different parts of the Americas, the five domesticated species were domesticated, and Capsicum annuum, the one that's most familiar to all of us, the jalapeno, the New Mexican chilies, and cayennes and all that kind of stuff, that was domesticated in Mexico. The other ones, the hotter ones, were domesticated in South America.
The name chili derives from Nahuatl, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. There is endless debates about nomenclature with chili peppers, and it's very difficult to pin anything down. But some people say that it did originate with the Nahuatls, and then the Spanish adopted it and, of course, changed it to their spelling, C-H-I-L-E. But it should be properly spelled C-H-I-L-L-I, but it doesn't really matter.
And we call them chili peppers because they replaced, in some cuisines, peppers, the things that we grind.
Yes, we also, it's sort of redundant to say chili peppers, but it's to avoid the confusion with black pepper and the confusion with chili con carne. So we use a redundant thing, chili pepper, and that seems to, you know, satisfy everyone. Of course, they debate about how it's supposed to be spelled, but what the heck.
Last week, we spoke about chocolate, and I understand the two were mixed together by the Aztecs and other people in Mesoamerica.
Very much so.
Roberto, why did they feel they complemented each other, and do you think that's still the case?
It is still the case. It's a wonderful beverage in many places in Oaxaca, Chiapas, in the south particularly. They still make these drinks, tejate, popo in Chiapas, and they're so invigorating. When you have, they're not hot drinks based on milk. They are cold drinks based on water with the cacao ground, and sometimes they have a little chili, and they're very invigorating. They're very nourishing.
Now, we have to be careful when we use the word hot, because you mean hot,
hot
heated up rather,
right.
Because
it's
chilies can
chocolate.
Be very hot, right. As Dave pointed out. But in Mexican cooking, aren't chilies usually used just to warm the palate, not to create a lot of sweat on the forehead?
I would say it's a difficult thing to say, Leonard, in the sense, and I don't know, Dave, I hope you agree with me, it's such an intricate part of our food. Basically, it's so intricate, it's like part of our history, totally. So some things are cooked with chilies, but we cook with many chilies that are not necessarily that spicy, and those are the base of many of the sauces. You know, like when you make a delicious adobo of chile ancho, that's actually going to come out basically sweet. Mm. You know, you're going to add a little bit of chocolate to it, but it's very, very mild, and there are so many of them that I don't necessarily think it's just necessarily just to warm food up. It's just the nature of each recipe. That's what it has chilies.
Now, yeah, Dave, how were chilies used in South America where they originated? I've heard that the Inca may have used them as a form of currency.
Well, they were a form of currency because they were highly valued. But Roberto's point is excellent, because Mexican cuisine is so diverse, it's hard to pin down the usage. But if you think of chili peppers being used more as a food than as a spice, mm-hmm. then I think that will explain it. But basically, all over the Americas, they were doing the same things with chilies. They were making sauces out of them to spice up bland food. either that or drying them to powders and doing the same thing. You have to remember that many of the people were eating basically bland things, potatoes, manioc, and things like this. And chili peppers really helped with the spice to give some character to these things. And that persists to this day in other countries where chili peppers are used to even spice up corn dishes, which are essentially a corn gruel. And you add chili peppers, and it makes it a little more interesting corn gruel.
Right. Now, Roberto, what gives chilies their heat?
A substance called capsaicin, and it's actually a good substance. It's a substance that makes you feel good, as many of the I-N-E ending substances.
But like when I am making something like guacamole and I take a jalapeno, I cut off all of that white stuff in the middle, and I take out all the seeds because it's going to make the guacamole too hot.
No, please. Grind it all up and then use less, but don't take away. In my view, David, and I hope you share this with me.
Oh, I agree.
Taking the seeds off the chilies. First of anything, you've chosen that particular chili because you want the heat from it.
It'll give
serranos,
heat.
Jalapenos, chipotles, chiles de árbol. You're choosing them because you want the heat. Not only you are taking the heat away, you're taking a big part of the nutrition and flavor. So it's best to chop it all up first and then add a little less so it's not so spicy. But then you're getting all the benefits.
Now, Dave, why do some people enjoy eating foods with lots of heat other than as a way of cleaning out your sinuses?
Well, people used to think that it was related to the taste buds, but chili peppers do not affect the taste buds except that, you know, the taste buds are replaced every few days anyway. So if you hurt a few taste buds, it doesn't really matter. But we were also born, all of us, with capsaicin receptors in our mouth and tongue. And this leads people to think that maybe we co-evolved with chili peppers. And this is all genetic. Like, for example, some people are super tasters and some people are non-tasters. The same thing with a capsaicin receptor. Some people have a lot of them, which means they're very sensitive to any kind of chili pepper, and some have virtually none. And those are the people who can eat the super hot chilies up to a million Scoville heat units with no problem at all. They just don't have enough receptors.
Very common in white people.
Well, they're finding out that there's
You mean
no...
Europeans? But
yes.
I would think that Asians especially, for example, in Hunan, in Sichuan, and in Thailand, where food can get so incredibly hot that they would have higher tolerance rate levels.
They do. And it's very funny how Mexicans don't. They really don't. But when you come up to the United States, I mean, my family and friends come to me and eat what I'm cooking here, and they said, oh, my God, this is so spicy. And it's like, I have been trained by all of you to cook like that. You like it spicier than we do. It's
now,
amazing.
Now, Dave, if it is too hot, are there ways of cooling it down?
Well, the best thing to do is the thickest, heaviest dairy products you can find. There's a protein called casein, which strips the molecules off the receptors, and that's found in dairy products. But the thicker, the heavier, the better.
So you mean like yogurt?
Yogurt would be fine. It's used in India for that same purpose. We're talking about ice cream. We're talking about heavy cream. That will almost completely eliminate the heat in your mouth. If you say rinse your mouth with heavy cream, it'll go away instantly.
Right.
No, there's no other remedy that really works
this. If you don't have any of that, just rinse your mouth very strongly, you know, intensely.
But in Mexican food, there's often something that's like a sour cream, which I would think
a little bit, a tablespoon of cream would do.
Now, what happens to the heat of chilies when you cook them? Does it matter if does it matter?
The capsaicin is unaffected by freezing, heating, cooking in any way. It'll stay the same.
It is what it is. And
it
actually, you know, when I speak on my latest book, Truly Mexican, if you read the intros to the chapters, I say something. When you make something in the blender and you taste it right away, it is going to be spicier than it is going to be in the next few hours, because it's just when it's in the blender, it just you have excited it all, and it's all very out there. Once it, you know, sits down, it's going to be a little bit milder.
I'm talking with Chef Roberto Santibanez and with food historian Dave DeWitt on this week's Globivores look at chilies which were not known in the rest of the world until 1492, although they probably weren't brought back by Columbus, were they, Dave?
Well, we have records to show that there were some chili peppers brought back on the second voyage in 1493, but he wasn't the only one bringing them back, and, you know, it's really irritating to me for everything to be blamed on Columbus, when in reality, right after Columbus, there were dozens and dozens of explorers doing exactly the same thing.
Exactly.
Just because he was the first, if he had drowned on the way over, somebody else would have followed up and done exactly the same thing. So it doesn't really matter who brought him back. A lot of people brought him back. We think it was Columbus on his second voyage, but we don't really know for sure.
Roberta, we have a link on our show page to one of your recipes, ancho chilies stuffed with beef tenderloin, shiitakes, and cremini. You call for rehydrating dried ancho chilies in a mixture of water and cider vinegar flavored with piloncillo. Why cider vinegar, and why dried chilies rather than fresh chilies?
We use all of them, and I just wanted with this recipe and other recipes made with dried chilies to, you know, show that you can also use those dried chilies. And what you're doing with the piloncillo and the vinegar, it's a very wise Mexican. When you look back into these recipes, this is not an invention of mine. I mean, this is something that people do in Mexico for many years. And if you look at it, it's very smart. It's, if you taste the chile ancho just by itself, you're going to feel sweetness, tartness. It's going to have the acidity. And the only thing you're doing with all these ingredients is enhancing those things and bringing up the wonderful flavor of the chile, which can be really flat if you don't use other things. One of the best things that ever happened to the world was the mixture of the chiles that were native and the spices that came from abroad.
Like cinnamon?
It is, you know, if you only cook with the chile, you know, Dave, it can be sort of a little unidimensional.
Yes, it can.
You know,
yes, it can.
The best thing that happened was this mixture that allows us to create the most incredible foods on earth.
Well, Mexicans also smoke chilies.
Oh, yes.
We have chipotles.
Oh, yes.
They use dried ones. They use fresh ones.
Use that piloncillo mixture to hydrate chipotles, and you'll see what you have.
We have another recipe of yours, tomatillo salsa, which calls for either serrano or jalapeno peppers. What do you look for when you're selecting a pepper for a specific dish?
If you are choosing it green or dry, you know, fresh version or dry version, it's totally different what you'd be looking for. But in this particular recipe, a serrano pepper or a jalapeno pepper, you want them, you know, you want them like any other vegetable, healthy looking, dry, you know, not wet, not dry, but not wet, not soft spots. The color, it can vary because they can, you know, be very green or they can start turning.
Now, Dave, sometimes we see jalapenos with cracks in them. Does that make them less desirable?
No, that's fine. It's called corking, and it's especially true in the jalapenos grown in Mexico. Grown in the United States, the consumers prefer less corking. It has no effect whatsoever on the flavor.
Now, I wonder about what happened in Asia. Because, in fact, we see very different kinds of chilies from Thailand and China. Do they mutate a lot? Do they cross-pollinate with other plants, at least in other kinds of chilies?
If you think of the analogy of dogs and mutts and chili peppers,
right.
It's a perfect analogy just because the same kind of crossbreeding amidst chili varieties happens just like with dog varieties. So if you think about that, and what you have to do is when you have you have to standardize by conventional breeding to get a variety that breeds true is what you have to do. After there have been hybrids, you've got to take the ones you like and preserve them as a variety.
Now, bell peppers a variety?
Bell peppers are a variety. They were developed from the poblano when people were looking for a totally mild, and there was a mutant poblano that didn't have any heat, and they worked with that mutant to develop the bell pepper.
And in a different country with different soil, with different weather, you know, it creates different chiles.
I'm pleased to announce that we've begun a collaboration with the New York World, which is part of Columbia University's School of Journalism. and it has begun tracking information about food coming into New York through the Hunts Point Market in the Bronx. They sent us some interesting data about where New York chilies are sourced, including the fact that significant amounts of certain chilies like habaneras are grown in hothouses in the Netherlands. Did you know that?
I do.
So are we no longer just getting chilies from Mexico and the southwest of the United States?
No, we're not longer, and it's a problem.
China is flooding the market, even in Mexico, with the same varieties of chilies, but just grown in China rather than in Mexico.
Mexicans are buying Chinese chilies.
Yes, they are.
It's a deeper problem than just, you know.
This is called globalization.
It's not only that. It's a big problem. It would get really political and really awful.
Well, maybe another show. We thank you both so much for being with us. And we'd also like to thank the New York World for providing data about the types, volume, and sources of peppers coming into New York City. We're very excited about this collaboration. We'll have more from them in the coming weeks. And, of course, my thanks to our two guests, Dave DeWitt, food historian and author of numerous books, including the Chili Pepper Encyclopedia. Roberto Santibanez, he has two Fonda restaurants now.
Yes, here
one
in the
Brooklyn
city.
And one in Manhattan.
7th Avenue in Brooklyn, Avenue B in Manhattan.
And also his latest book is Tacos, Tortas, and Tamales.
And I'm honored, David. Thank you.
Thank you.